You are listening to the Hospice Chaplaincy Show, a show where we talk about psychospiritual and psychosocial aspects of end-of-life care. And now, here is your host, Saul.
Thank you very much for joining us on this episode of the Hospice Chaplaincy Show. I'm Saul Ebema, and my guest today is Reverend Joelle John. She's a pastoral thanatologist. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
I feel like when people who work in end-of-life care or in the field of death and dying, in most cases are driven there by personal experiences or intellectual curiosity. How did you end up in this field of death and dying?
Well, I suspect a little of both of those things. Exposure when I was younger and some sort of core memories, and also absolute intellectual curiosity. Death is sort of that one thing on this side we can never really know all or conquer all or have all the answers. So it's just a constant resource of deeper thinking and exploration.
So at what age in your formative years did your understanding of death become much more real as an impermanence, as a reminder of our impermanence?
I would say the first real impactful experience was when my grandmother died, my mom's mom, my Nana, we called her. And my mom was an only child, and she came home after being at the hospital. My Nana had end-stage lymphoma and was very ill. And I remember my mom coming home and getting out of the car, and she was sobbing because she was having to make all of these decisions, these medical decisions, on her own. And I remember this was the day that she had to tell them that she did not want my grandmother put on a vent or any more invasive procedures done, that she was basically saying no more comfort measures. And I know that that was really hard for her, but she was a nurse and she knew that that was the best choice.
So as your mom was going through these emotions, what could you, you know, at that young age, how were you interpreting all these things?
My thing was to just to go up to my mom and hug her. And my mother was always very open about death. And she didn't try to really shield us. I think she took into account our ages. I think I was 9 at the time. But she was very honest about it. And I really appreciate that she took that particular tack with us, was to be honest and upfront about what she was going through, what she was feeling. She didn't get into the weeds of the medical parts of it.
Yeah.
But just sort of the things that have to do with that, the core things that of these decisions and the impact it was having on her.
Yeah. You know, that is really impressive for your mom to be able to model that, especially we live in a culture that is death denying, where parents are much quicker to shield their children from that. I can imagine, and this is, we are talking about 2024. I can imagine when your mom was going through this, you were much younger, so many years back. So she really, it looks like she modeled, you know, how to walk alongside a loved one who is dying powerfully there.
It is, and I see now, of course, I mean, it really helped me. It's sort of maybe that planted the seeds of my own calling. But I see now when I work with some families how hard it is to really navigate that. You know, we don't give our society a lot of language. You know, you and I, because we work in this field, could talk about it in all sorts of ways, but societally we don't have good tools for really discussing it.
Yeah. So before we go any further, let's you're a pastoral thanatologist, so let's break down some definitions. Thanatology, I think, comes from the Greek word thanos, is the personification of death. So thanatology is the study of death. So what is pastoral thanatology?
Well, pastoral thanatology is, as you said, it's the study of death, but it's death, dying, and grief and grieving. So sort of the full scope
spectrum,
around the death process. And the pastoral part is sort of like to me, it's sort of like when you think of a pastor, sort of leading and walking beside people. And that's those two things combined, the spiritual aspects and the things that I lean into. allow me to look at it, like when I study things through that lens, through sort of what it does to our spirit and all of those different areas of death and of the dying process and of the grieving process and loss.
Hmm. In fact, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is credited as the founder of thanatology. In your work, what are some of the spiritual aspects of end-of-life care?
Some of the spiritual aspects are, I guess the word existential leaps to mind. I don't know how well we are equipped to grapple with not existing anymore.
Mm.
And I think whether you have faith, don't have faith, sort of what you were taught is your embedded theology about what happens when you die and after you die, I feel like all of those things, and then when you add in sort of how you lived your life and sort of the layers of regrets or just sort of all that stuff that comes up when you're facing the end.
Yeah.
It can feel very overwhelming, I imagine.
I remember over 10 years ago, I remember visiting a patient. She was in a nursing home and she was going through this sense of existential despair in that I feel like I have nothing to live for. And she was craving for the medical professionals, especially the doctor, to, this is how she put it, to put her to sleep. She's like, my life has no meaning. When my dog was suffering, I put my dog to sleep. Why can't this doctor do this for me? And that really it brought home the reality of existential despair in that sense. That where people, sometimes when people are terminally ill and they feel totally useless. Have you encountered situations like that?
Oh, a lot. I just had a patient who died about a week ago. Oh, he was such a nice, such a kind man. He was a psychologist and had worked with adolescents. And we had sort of, as he was getting sicker and sicker, he had chosen comfort measures. He had decided, I don't want to have all this chemo and stuff anymore. I'm done. But as he knew that he was getting sicker and sicker, I think that's when he really started to want to talk about his regrets. And in my other role as a chaplain, I was able to sit and sort of hear what those were and kind of hold space for them. I can't fix them, but I can honor who he is as a person and kind of gently look at some of these things and help him to find what he has within himself to forgive himself. Because I find that people that have carry a lot to the end tend to struggle more at the end. That's just been sort of my you know, evidence from what I've seen. But he had the same thing, like, can they just give me a lot of medicine? Well, no. We can't, but tell me why you feel that way. Do you know what I mean? That's the hard part.
Yeah, no, existential despair is a real spiritual issue in end-of-life care. What are some of other aspects you've encountered in your work other than existential despair?
Well, this is just a little bit more of the existential is the issues with God, anger, feeling left. Family issues are probably the biggest thing that I see. You know, people who haven't spoken to a child, an adult child in a long time, or a sibling, and the fight maybe now doesn't seem like the big deal it seemed when you have all the time in the world. You know what I mean? That sort of family discord is a big one. And there are people who don't talk and sometimes don't even remember why they stopped talking. So one of the things I do when I give talks is that fight really worth it? Or is it something that maybe sitting down and talking it through might be well worth it?
I like that we are pointing out some of these, you know, prominent aspects especially in terms of spiritual care at the end of life. What other aspects are there that you found to be prominent as you walk alongside the dying?
I think a lot of people aren't so afraid of being dead. And I, pardon me for being so blunt. I think they're afraid that there's going to be pain and agony and it's not going to be managed. And some people fear they will be alone. Some people fear they won't be left alone. Mm. Do you know what I mean? There are some people that prefer when they've had their visits, please just leave me in silence. And there are some people who are terrified to be in the room by themselves. And some of those things, I don't know if there's a particular cause that can be distilled or if that's just a feeling that comes to them. Do you know what I mean? Is it a core memory of it as maybe as a child being left alone or part of their personality? Or is it because they're facing this huge thing and some people do like to process alone? Mm. And I'll bet you have seen when family's there and it's this wonderful, loving family and people are all around and the person waits until they're all gone to die.
Yes, yes.
Do you know what I mean? They wait till everybody's gone. Finally, you know, we encourage them, you know, go get something to eat. You can't pour from an empty cup. Go get some sustenance. And the patient dies the second they all walk out the door.
Yes. And it's really, I think it's part of traits built, maybe probably like you said, from life experiences that shape us like that, where some people like, if this is my problem, I deal with it better alone. While others, they just want that consistent presence. And I've also noticed in grief counseling that when the patient does that and dies alone, sometimes the children feel guilty. Why did we leave? Mm-hmm. You know, so it really, sometimes it creates trauma in grief. But it is the patient's wish, you know, to die alone. So it's really important to know. Yeah, it's important to know some of those aspects. What do you like about being a pastoral thanatologist?
I really like getting to work with people, and I love when I can get people who haven't really considered anything about end of life and start at least thinking about it, because I do a lot of community education. So at least if I can put my foot in their little mental door just a little bit, to just at least get the conversation started, that for me is like the biggest win. If I can just get them maybe having a conversation with their significant other when they get home or their kids, you know what I mean? Just, hey, I saw this crazy woman talk today and she was talking about death. What do you guys think of that? Do you know what I mean? However it comes out, that makes me happy. And also when I talk about grief and the grief isn't always because you lose someone to death and that we all carry a lot of grief. So being able to just sort of explore all those things with people who may not even realize that that's what's happening is really satisfying for me.
So now, how does it work? Shed some light for us. So you just meet somebody and you begin to talk about death and dying and grief. How does it work?
I go out into the community and I like to go senior centers, community centers, and I offer to talk. And I tell them what I'm going to talk on. And senior centers are usually where I head first. But I'm speaking on a panel in March there's a whole bunch of folks for aging in place. So I'm going to be talking about how hospice comes to you. Hospice isn't a place. It's you know, it's a whole caring philosophy. And we'll go wherever you are. And if that means at home, we'll come to home. But so I will talk on things like advanced directives. I can talk on, you know, sort of hospice 101. I like to talk on things like grief, and I'll run grief groups in the community too. So I like to just get out and get people engaged in the conversation in whatever space, libraries, wherever somebody will let me. It usually goes better than people fear. You know what I mean? Like, people are often surprised because I like to use a little humor.
How is the the community response to these events?
It's funny because some of the wonderful folks, and I love the people that work in senior centers. Some of the directors are, I mean, they have their finger on the pulse. And sometimes they'll say, is it heavy? Because nobody wants to talk about death here. And that always makes me giggle. But it tends to be like feast or famine. If I start a grief group, for example, a few people will come, maybe they have a very acute loss and really, really need support. And then sometimes it takes me 2 or 3 months to get it built up because people realize that it's okay to go. And sometimes it takes a little word of mouth that this is a safe place and it's going to be okay. And for the other talks, you know, the talks on advanced directives, the talks on Hospice 101, those are often pretty well received because of the curiosity factor. Do you know what I mean? And they can kind of go, but keep it still sort of on the periphery. You know what I mean? They'll eat the cookies I bring and listen, and we'll have a laugh. But I hope that, you know, I get somewhere in their psyche to at least have the conversation or start having the conversation.
With that, we'll take a little break again. Our guest is Reverend Joelle John. She's a pastoral thanatologist. We'll be right back.
Continuing to be a leader in the field of spiritual care at the end of life, Hospice Chaplaincy provides high-quality professional development webinars that will improve your practice of spiritual care at the end of life. Check out our latest webinars at www.hospicechaplaincy.com.
I'm Sole Bem, and we continue our conversation with Reverend Johns. Before the break, you spoke about going to community centers and holding events in libraries to educate the community in the aspects of death and dying and advance directives. I find that in most Western cultures, people are scared of talking about death or even dealing with death. So scholars, I was doing some research and I found 4 prominent reasons why people in Western cultures are scared of talking about death. The first reason the scholars give is urbanization. In Western cultures, individuals are increasingly removed from nature and witnessing of the life-death cycle. The process of urbanization has led to people having less sense of community with others and few common rituals to express feelings and guide behavior. What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot there. That's layered. The urbanization and the less sort of connection to nature is huge because when we're not seeing the cycles of nature, when we don't see things grow, die, you know, season comes around, grow, you know, live, die. When we're out of touch with that, what is our reference point?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? What is teaching us that in sort of, and I'm talking in ways where you're not even necessarily aware of it. I'm lucky enough to live in New England. So we have, you know, seasons that are very distinct from each other. It's still. You don't even necessarily aware of it, but when the fall comes and then the winter starts to come and you feel yourself kind of wintering a little bit more, hibernating. And that is sort of like the death time of year. And then spring comes around and then you have birth. And I do think we're disconnected. And I don't want to slam social media because I think it does some good things, but I think we've become disconnected. You know, it's so much easier to pop a meme up there than to actually sit with an uncomfortable feeling. And I'm guilty as charged too. You know, I am not going to say I don't use it as a distraction.
I also agree with the point of urbanization. I grew up in rural Africa. So when you're in the rural areas, you know, you're in the farmlands, so you're with animals. So you see the life cycle of animals, of birds, of plants, of people, you know, relative people, neighbors die. So you live with these realities. They are there. They are constant. And yeah, so I think urbanization is a big aspect why people are scared of talking about death or dealing with it. The second reason they give is healthcare practices segregate the aged and dying from the general populace into nursing homes and hospitals, making death a foreign experience that elicits the fear of being alone.
Yes.
That's powerful.
That is powerful. I was just talking to someone about this, is that, you know, back before the Civil War, we laid people out in the front parlor.
Yeah.
When somebody died and the family was around and it was sort of tended to all within the family. And then, you know, friends could come by to call And then, you know, the funeral industry, and I'm certainly not going to give them a hard time because it serves a wonderful purpose. But when we got to embalming, then you could sort of hold someone over and make it more of a, but it's almost like the ritual lost some of its meaning. Mm-hmm. And now we don't seem to want to keep the intergenerational household. And I'm not sitting here living here with three generations either. So I'm certainly not one to tell anyone else how to live their life, but we do keep, and I go into a lot of facilities and we do tend to keep folks in institutionalized spaces. And I wonder, you know, but like, there's so many layers to that too, because financially sometimes we can't stop because we have to keep working.
Yeah.
So we can't really care for our aging parents. So it's almost like the structures are also keeping us from being able to reclaim that.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer to that.
I think that's important. You know, some people have 2, 3, 4 jobs, you know, so life has to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the third aspect, you mentioned a little bit about it, is the movement from extended family to nuclear family has limited the opportunity to see aged relatives die and to experience death as a natural part of the life cycle. That is so true, yeah. Right there.
it really is. And we do tend to shield our kids because we think they can't handle it. And I don't know if that's the best way to go about it. Like I said, I know for me, with my mom being so open with me, I think that made death less scary.
Yeah. And the fourth reason why Americans have difficulty in dealing with death is the increase of secularization. Religion minimizes the impact of physical death by focusing on the hereafter, endowing death with a special meaning and purpose, and provides the future and immortality. With the decline in religion, there has been a marked loss of these coping mechanisms. What are your thoughts around that?
That's a great question because one of the other things I do is I'm a part-time pastor at a church, and it's a shrinking church. And, you know, it's interesting because you can't help but see that we're becoming less religious. But I don't think we're becoming less spiritual. I would push back a little on that we've sort of thrown out every aspect of religion. I think people are being more discerning, and they're not just buying dogma without investigation. But I think people are also looking more within and more to their own personal relationship with a higher being or the divine, as opposed to needing to be a big part of capital R religion.
I think what the scholars are saying about that part is that in every religious tradition, there's a conversation or a theological framework for death and dying. So the practitioners of that religion or that faith then are constantly aware of the realities of death and dying. Now, when those realities are out of the picture and you're just living life, unless you're intentional in learning about death and dying, you might not hear it until somebody next to you has died. But people in religious frameworks, in most cases, probably hear this almost every religious week, you know. So I think that is what they mean. Because the idea is that the more we talk about death, the more we become familiar with it and the more comfortable we become with it. And you're encountering that as you go into those communities trying to educate people about death and dying and advance directives.
I do. And I think you're right. And I do think there's almost sort of a generational difference too. I find that some of my older folks that I work with still have that connection to sort of thinking about the afterlife. But I haven't really seen that it lessens that existential dread. And that's sort of the missing piece for me, is if we're talking about it, but are we is it really sort of sinking in? Like, are we just sort of going through the motions, or are we really contemplating it? Like I love the Buddhist tradition of the five remembrances. And when you get up every day, you know, the first one being like, I'm going to die. That is what I am like created to do. This body is not permanent, and it's going to be, I know that. And everything I love, everything I care about, everyone I love will be taken from me. Either they're going to die or I'm going to die. And they do that every day.
Mm.
And I think that's not a bad exercise to sort of remember that, because think of how differently we might live every day if we did bring death a little closer. Maybe some of those arguments that we have really aren't worth it. You know, maybe we'd make different choices. I like to think about that.
When you go into this community education, what are some of the challenges that you encounter as you stand there and begin to educate on grief, death, and dying? What are some of the challenges?
Aside from some of the sort of obvious ones of people just not wanting to talk about death, I find grief is so under-addressed. I think people are given, 3 to 5 days off from work if they lose a spouse?
Wow.
That boggles my mind. But I see people carry a lot of grief, and they don't even realize that they're carrying it until I start listing out sometimes some of the other ways that we grieve. Divorce is a source, even if you want the divorce, but that can be a source of grief. Losing a job, not having the life you thought you were going to have, can cause grief. Not being able to speak with have a good relationship with one of your kids or all of your kids. There are so many other ways we come to grief, and we carry it. And I feel like when it's unexpressed or untended to, it's easily flipped to anger.
Hmm.
And I think that's some of the reason for some of our polarization.
Well said. With that, we'll take a little break and we'll be right back.
If someone you know is suffering from mental health issues and could use some support, please call the National Alliance for Mental Illness Helpline. It is a free nationwide peer support service providing information, resource referrals, and support to people living with a mental health condition. To contact the NAMI Helpline, please call 1-800-950-NAMI. That's 1-800-950-6264. Monday through Friday, or send an email to info@nami.org.
I'm Sole Bem, and we continue our conversation with Reverend Johns. Earlier in the conversation, you spoke about talking to people about advance directives. Could you define it for us?
Advance directives are, in a very simple term, they are the way that we tell others, when we can't speak for ourselves, what we want done, basically. So if we were to be incapacitated in some way through various things, we have the MOLST or the POLST, depending on your state, you have your living will, you have your healthcare proxy. These are the things that tell people what you want done medically if you cannot speak for yourself. The physician's order for life-sustaining treatment, the POLST, or in Massachusetts, we use what's called a MOLST, which is a medical order for life-sustaining treatment, is one that people do with their physician. And you can be very specific on it in terms of, if you were to become incapacitated from disease of, or say you were in a, like say you have a terminal illness and you take a big decline and you are unconscious. On this document, you could have talked to your doctor about, do I want a feeding tube? Do I want to be artificially hydrated? Do I want CPR? Because a lot of people, you know, we see CPR in the movies and on TV shows, and it's like, woo, it's just, oh, look, and there you wake up and you're all happy, and nobody talks about all the broken ribs and all the other horrible things when somebody is fragile that happens when CPR is performed. And I hate to be graphic, but there's a lot of gravitas towards knowing that. And so I'm not shy about talking about that. Then you have your healthcare proxy, which is the person that you appoint who should know all of your wishes because of an ongoing conversation, and they can make medical decisions if you can't they can make those for you. And then you have, of course, the living will, which is what you write to put in sort of specifically in your own words, what matters to you and what you would like as well.
So why is it important for someone to have advance directive?
Because when you're waiting, as I said before, till the house is on fire,
yeah,
it's going to be so much more difficult for everybody that loves you to do what they feel is best for you if you've never talked about it.
It gives your loved ones, in a sense, it gives your loved ones a peace of mind. Because I remember visiting a patient the other day, and the kids are like, this is what mom wants. No, this is what is best for mom. Because mom did not have these advanced directives. Now it is causing tremendous chaos amongst the children. And now mom cannot speak for herself. And in the process of figuring it out, there's a lot of conflict between the children. So really, I think it's important if you're listening to this and you haven't done it and you have a chance to do it, it provides a peace of mind for your loved ones. It also minimizes stress, you know.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. And I can't stress enough about how many times I've seen that too. Yeah. And if I can pull from my own experience, my mom, she died actually in her sleep. But my mom and I used to talk about, as I said, she was sort of my inspiration for getting into this field and sort of about my calling. And when she died, my dad was really, he was kind of like, what if I'd called, you know, the ambulance, and what if I, you know, I should have woken up. And I said, Dad, mom always said, do not do CPR on me. If I am, you know, if I have gone unconscious and I am dying, don't do it. Like, do not do anything invasive for me. I want to die in my sleep, and I am not afraid of dying. And my mother and I had that conversation so often, probably because of the nature of what I do. But we talked about it so much so that when she did die, I was so sad, but my grief had sort of a soft edge to it, because I knew that she went the way she wanted to go. I knew because we talked about it, because she made her wishes known. And that really helped with my grief journey. To know that she sort of did it her way.
Yeah, that's powerful. And that really reinforces the power of having advanced directives, because you get the medical care you want, and then everybody around you becomes peaceful. And you're right, it helps in the grieving process. I read this morning that there are 5 reasons why talking about death improves life. The first reason they gave in that article is it will make you healthier. Death awareness leads humans to start thinking more about enjoying life. So it makes you more healthier. And when you're enjoying life, it makes you happier. And then the third reason is you care more about others. You realize the humanity of other people, and you begin to care more about other people. That is the power of death awareness. And the fourth is your personal goals will be better prioritized, because you realize that, oh, I don't have much time on this earth. Tomorrow is not guaranteed to me. So you live life with much more purpose, with much more intention. And the fifth reason is you'll die better. Why? Because you'll have planned for it. That is why.
Oh, I love that.
So thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
What are your final thoughts?
My final thoughts are, I love platforms like this that help to expand awareness that there are folks that will come and talk to you. There are ways that we can sit with each other and have these hard conversations. And I think if we do it more often, it'll become easier and easier. It's just a matter of sort of getting past the hurdle and making it a little less scary.
That was Reverend Joelle Jones. She's a pastoral thanatologist. Our studio engineer is Brian Mackinder, and I'm Sole Bema. Thank you for listening.
This show was brought to you by Hospice Chaplaincy, promoting excellence in spiritual care at the end of life. This episode was recorded at Audio Hive Podcasting in Joliet, Illinois. You can find our podcast everywhere podcasts are available. If you enjoy listening to the show, please don't forget to give us your feedback by writing a review on iTunes. For more information, please visit www.hospicechaplaincy.com.